Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. Delighted to have you listening as we jump into a holiday season. The weather is getting cold, but sports are in full swing across the board, and we have plenty to talk about on today's episode, and we are going to be chatting with Jacob Rosen. He is a student with the University of Oregon Warsaw Sports Marketing Center MBA program, working on a sports MBA. Also a consultant for the Akron Rubber Ducks, a Cleveland Indians AA affiliate. But most importantly for our podcast, he is a writer and contributor for a sports analytics blog, as well as the basketball analytics blog, The Nylon Calculus, and Waiting for Next Year, a blog devoted to Cleveland sports. So we're going to have a great discussion with Jacob on the growing community of sports analytics, going all the way back to his days coming up with his own version of the BCS rankings in the late 90s to what he's been writing about lately, and the growing interest in the field across the board from fans to player personnel decision makers and everything in between. But before we get to our conversation with Jacob, we have this episode's helpful tool. This episode's helpful tool is called Tag Crowd. It's located at tagcrowd.com. It's completely free, and it's a great, quick, and easy way to come up with word clouds. So we all agree and talk about the value of listening and social media listening across the web, or even just listening through various emails and feedback that you store in CRM. We end up with a lot of text to break down. Some people have proprietary software, but those that don't will find this episode's helpful tool, Tag Crowd, really helpful. Just go to tagcrowd.com and you can upload a Word file, an XML file. You can just type in the URL of a web address, or you can paste in just a bunch of words, whether it's a bunch of tweets, a bunch of feedback emails, or whatever you may want to look at, and it'll instantly deliver a pretty good detailed word cloud and report for you about the words that are appearing most frequently. You can break it down by language if you have different languages you're looking at. You can also filter out certain words if you don't want to see that certain words are in there that you already know about. It's just a great way to get a quick look at what's being talked about when you have just a bunch of text to review. And for those that don't have those expensive software programs that are spitting out sentiment analysis and whatnot, it is completely free and it's super quick, and it can be very helpful and very useful for anyone in the marketing world and sports marketing world in particular, especially for those monitoring the day-to-day musings on social media where the volume can at times be overwhelming in the sports world. So that's this episode's helpful tool. It's called tagcrowd.com. You can find more information on that helpful tool, as well as all of them, at the podcast website, dsmsports.net. And you can follow me on Twitter, your host, Neil Horowitz, at njh287 for good links and tools like that I tweet out. But that's this episode's helpful tool, and we will be coming right back at you with a great interview, really good conversation about sports analytics with today's guest, Jacob Rosen. Stay tuned. All right, that was this episode's helpful tool. It's called Tag Crowd, a really quick and easy way to generate a word cloud, whether you're working with pasting in a bunch of tweets or looking at a website you want to break down, or maybe even checking out one of our guests today's many blogs, because he's all over the internet. And our featured guest today on the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast, we're delighted to have Jacob Rosen with us. He is an MBA candidate at the University of Oregon Warsaw Sports Marketing Center, as well as a consultant for the Akron Rubber Ducks, an affiliate of the Cleveland Indians, and a contributor and writer for sports analytics blog, Waiting for Next Year, and the Nylon Calculus, a basketball analytics blog. Welcome to the podcast, Jacob.
Thank you, Neil. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate the energy you put behind getting all those different things down. That's not easy.
Hey, you put all the energy into to embody and actually do all that stuff, so I might as well make sure that you get credit for all of it.
Thank you.
So as we said, Jacob does a great job. We're going to have most of our conversation today will focus on the growing world of sports analytics, of which Jacob is right in the middle of, doing a lot of writing and research about it. And we're going to kind of look at it from all angles, especially as it applies to its growth through social and digital media. But before we get into that fun stuff, Jacob, of course, we like to get to know all of our guests. And you are on your way to a great career in sports business. So give us an idea of where you've been so far, how you've gotten involved in a lot of the writing you've done, and what you're doing now, and also any tips along the way.
So yeah, I grew up in Akron, Ohio. I went to undergrad at the University of Dayton in applied mathematical economics. Spent a couple years doing nonprofit fundraising, and really realized, you know, the place I want to be is in the sports business world. So started up here at the University of Oregon, a sports MBA program in August, and it's been really fun so far. My goal in the overall industry is to work in business insights and analytics and do community involvement and, you know, regional involvement for a pro team. So my interest is really giving back to a team's region, community development kind of work, and using numbers and analytics to influence decision-making in those fields. So that's where I would like to go long-term. And I've been writing in all different websites for years now. I joined at the Cleveland Sports Blog Waiting for Next Year back in early 2009. I was media relations intern for the Akron Arrows at the time that year. I was a media relations director the next summer, between summers in college when they had opening. And I've been involved in all sorts of websites ever since. And this year, after going to the Sloan Sports Analytics Conference in Boston, I really, you know, took a lot of energy behind giving back to some other different sports analytics websites. So I started writing at Sports Analytics Blog. I've been writing now for the Nylon Calculus site for the last few months. So it's been a really exciting year for me, writing and exploring different topics at a bunch of different websites and connecting and networking with people on Twitter way more often. In terms of a tip or something, you know, I've been writing since I was a freshman in college. I've been writing on all sorts of different websites. So writing, putting your name out there, and really just networking more and more and more can never be a bad thing. When I was in undergrad, I was super involved with lots of different things on campus. I did student government elections. I was there in chief of my school newspaper. And I loved all those bits, but I always could have done more to kind of chat with people in the real sports industry and set myself better up for, you know, an internship or a job or have more people willing to bat for me. You know, I ended up just back at home and did something in the nonprofit world. And while that was really helpful for my, you know, my skill set, and I loved being back home and being involved in my community, also could have done more while I was in school and everything too. You know, really figure out a niche for myself earlier on. So you can never network too early and too often.
Fantastic advice. So let me jump back real quickly to your time at the University of Dayton. Did you know you wanted to get involved at some point in sports at that point? And how did you end up selecting that major? Because that's a very good major to have on the resume, especially for teams looking for folks that are engrossed in that data and analytics world. So was sports early on a main focus for you, and did that go into your applied math major?
Yeah, absolutely. I was ranking. I'd created my own BCS ranking, you know, way back in 2005 or 6. So I'd been writing and doing things with sports and numbers since, you know, I played Little League and way back in the day. I'd always loved sports, always kind of wanted to work in sports, but never really knew what I could do. And so when I came down to picking a college, I looked at a lot of different schools, looked at Northwestern, Emory, and almost went to Ohio State where my whole family went. But really Dayton, for me, was a great fit because of the community there. And the fact that they had already that established major. There was like four of us that did it, but compared to most any other school, you would have to mix and match and create your own independent major of like a combination of a math or a, you know, some sort of math economics topic and a social science. So at Dayton, I just enjoyed how I could walk right in. They had a outline of my 4 years for me. I also added in a minor in Spanish and business and did all these sorts of extracurricular activities. And the community there at Dayton just was fantastic. So, you know, at different schools, I would have to go to five different buildings to figure out what my freshman year might look like in terms of my classes. And at Dayton, they, you know, acted like I was a celebrity my first day on campus and walked me to all sorts of different departments. And so it was a really, really good 4 years.
That's great. And also real quickly, if you can, just tell our listeners a little about how you got involved in all these writing activities online and was it you seeking out places to publish your writing, or mostly just writing yourself and publishing and getting noticed and getting those opportunities at Waiting for Next Year and Sports Analytics Blog?
Initially, it was just some lucky opportunities, honestly. When I was doing those BCS rankings I was doing 2006, 2007, I would honestly just write an email to like my dad and his friends and some of my friends that are interested in sports. So this is like a 16-year-old kid and his Yahoo email address, just sending out his Excel files of his BCS or then NBA and baseball rankings and like, you know, a few paragraphs of, you know, what I thought about the sports world that week. So that's all I was doing in 2007 and 2008. Early 2009, I started, you know, reading the Waiting for Next Year site that had been around for just a little while and started sending it to them, just saying, hey, you know, you guys like sports, you might enjoy this. And so they asked me in 2009 to join the site. So they had reached out to me for that. And ever since then, there's just been opportunity after opportunity. The Arrows, I had some friends there who, you know, was able to get the internship there and, you know, met the new owner a couple years back. And now the site's this year, I've really taken a little more initiative. And that's, you know, part of the, you know, MBA life where you're always networking, always looking for more, you know, projects and research opportunities to work on. So this year I've taken a lot more initiative myself to reach out to some different websites, and I've had to turn down a few. It's not easy sometimes when you're trying to just do more and more, but it's been a really good year in terms of writing it all sorts of things.
That's a good problem to have.
Yeah. When you turn down offers, that's when you know you've made it a little bit.
How about just the decision to pursue the MBA program at University of Oregon anyway, as opposed to jumping into a job full time? What played into the decision, I guess, to go to the business program now?
I took the GMAT when I was a senior in college, so I knew I had always had an interest in doing an MBA somewhere. So I took the GMAT, you know, maybe 3 or 4 years ago now, and so I had a 5-year window with which to start MBA school. I always knew I wanted to. It was just a matter of whether I wanted to do a traditional MBA, you know, just go to a really good school or, an Ohio State or something like that, or go to one of the top sports business programs, sports MBA programs. In Oregon, always ranked at the top of the list. I actually came out here to visit just generally the state and the Pacific Northwest with my family shortly after graduating college. And I just, you know, literally we were hanging out in Portland. I shot an email to the people here at the Warsaw program and said, hey, I'll be there later today. Any chance I can meet with you guys? And, you know, sat in on a sports econ class and absolutely loved it. And so it was always on my radar when I was working at the nonprofit, and really, you know, set myself to work at the nonprofit for 2 years and then started it up. And of the sports MBA programs, I thought this was a great fit for me. You know, they have, you know, the marketing approach to it. It's just an MBA. I always had this fascination with Portland and the Pacific Northwest. So it's been a lot of fun, and you know, different approaches to get in the sports where you can just start working. And for me, I think I needed just a little bit more of energy and, you know, resources and knowledge of the industry. And so, you know, in 2 years time, hopefully with a job in hand and ready to do work for the rest of my life.
That's great. And hey, you can't argue with one of Oregon's most famous benefactors, and that's Phil Knight, of course, who has a little bit of success in sports business himself.
Yeah, it, you know, this place, this program is pretty special, and there are a lot of opportunities from it. So I would highly encourage folks to look at it, of course.
And I will say, just going back to your tip as well, great tip is just to have the initiative to write and to network. And a great way to do that, too, is to read a lot. And when you are reading, to get feedback and to correspond, leave a comment on someone's post, reach out to them on Twitter or LinkedIn and say you really enjoyed what they had to write, or something they're doing with their team. It's a great way to be proactive, and people will appreciate when you reach out to them with positive feedback. But great hearing your story. I want to hear a little more about how you got really interested in the world of sports analytics as well, though. So tell me a little about where the interest. You talked about your experience at the Sloan Conference, which is a great conference at MIT now, that goes over sports business and sports analytics. So how did your interest first get started in there, and how you got involved with Sports Analytics Blog?
I think, you know, if you were a kid that liked numbers and you grew up in the 90s and early 2000s, almost every one of us, you know, I think Nate Silver did the same thing. You know, he tried to create his own, you know, formula for batting average or, you know, on-base percentage or OPS back then, and tried to create your own college football ranking system as opposed to the BCS. So I think that was just the thing that sports-crazed numbers kids did in the late 90s and early 2000s. And so I was doing it from a young age, and it really has pushed me to, you know, read Moneyball and to keep up to date in some of the things and trends happening in the industry. And it's been fascinating to see what the, you know, the progression is and the use of this word sports analytics and what it has really meant to a lot of different people over the last few years. So I've always been fascinated by it since I was 10 or so years old. I know lots of different websites that are around for years and years, and now I feel like a member of the community a little bit.
It is. It's a very, I guess, stereotypical thing to say, but was Moneyball and that, and when Michael Lewis put that book out, was that the turning point that made analytics go from more of a geek and blogger world, I guess, to more mainstream discussion, or is that more of a misconception and was already growing really before that?
I think it's, you know, obviously a misconception. It was already growing. Lewis is a journalist, and he was reporting on things that had already happened and were already happening. So I think the geeks versus the jocks thing is always overblown. And Moneyball itself, you know, what did the A's do? They just, in a sense, used data to exploit a market inefficiency. They just found a little thing. People weren't valuing walks. They weren't valuing on-base percentage. And let's go find the people that are being undervalued because of that. And they were successful in that way. They also, sure, they had a streak of developing some really good pitchers all in a row. You know, they had Mark Mulder and Barry Zito and Tim Hudson all in a row, all at the same time. And that's what the A's did. It wasn't anything, you know, beyond what was already happening in terms of innovation with data and all sorts of sports. So I think the whole Moneyball thing, the geeks versus jocks thing, gets overplayed, certainly. And I think most folks would say that by now.
So it seems like the whole wave analytics then started with the front office folks like the Billy Beans of the world who started utilizing those sort of that hidden data that was in there. And then the media like Michael Lewis and then the ESPNs that came along and maybe told the story a little more, and it started to get more interest among the fans. I mean, does that sound like an accurate depiction of the historical cycle of it? And is it the fans really carrying the momentum now?
I think Bill James, you know, you mentioned Bill James deserves a lot of the credit for being one of the first people to just start publishing research and innovation and different ways to approach sports statistics and analytics. So, yeah, I think that's a better, accurate representation. To a certain extent, though, it's whoever you think are driving the innovation in the industry. Yes, there is a ton of value, and this is what I do is I try to advance public knowledge of the innovation. But I think still today, there's tons of proprietary behind-the-scenes team innovation that's happening that we don't know about. So there's two, you know, sides of the coin. The Moneyball thing was stuff that they were doing behind the scenes. And the publishing of the Moneyball book has been great because it's, you know, opened more people's eyes to the possibilities of sports analytics, you know, perhaps more people with computer tech backgrounds and things that can really advance the field more and more. And then there's the private side, which is still happening, you know, to this day, of teams building up departments and systems and all sorts of realms of using data to assist, you know, more informed decisions. That's really all sports analytics is just using all data possible, all available resources possible to make better decisions. And so I think, you know, it's happening in all sorts of ways. More public, you know, articles and innovation is a good thing too, but really teams are the ones that I think will benefit most from this kind of thing because they're trying to outdo each other to have more success on the field. That's really the result of making better decisions is hopefully you have better players and will win more games.
Oh yeah, and that's the hope for your small mid-market teams like an Oakland, like a Tampa Bay, is to try to find those little hidden data there with the analytics and beat those teams that way. But I also want to sort of just talk about what the sports analytics community is like right now. A sports analytics blog, for example, to which you do a great job contributing. Who is that for? Is that intended for? Is that really to stimulate conversation within that small but devoted sports analytics community out there that knows about this stuff, or is it really for the greater public who is developing a growing interest in what sports analytics is and is becoming?
You know, it's a tough question. Jonathan Gordon, who himself is just a senior at Notre Dame, founded the website, and it's just interesting to see who it's for. We do a lot of different articles at that website. Some, you know, poking fun at people and their, you know, approach to analytics, like you say, a Torrey Hunter of the world who just, you know, criticized all the people that are sports, their sabermetrics guys and said they never played and don't have any value, to, you know, doing these really intense industry roundups of all the articles and research that's happening in the industry. So I think Sports Analytics Blog, by nature, is almost for those niche people that are really interested. But we want to be a resource. We want to be a tool that people can use to learn more. And I think that's the mission of Nylon Calculus as well, which is, you know, led up by Ian Levy in the Hardwood Paroxysm Basketball Network, is to be a resource for people to learn more. We don't want to just be stuck in this niche of the, you know, 2% of sports consumers that love and are always inundated and know that OPS is better than batting average and, you know, PER is better than points per game. But to a certain extent, we're stuck. It's growing a little bit, but it's a battle of whether you know and embrace the fact that you're riding for this niche, or whether you're trying to really bring more people into the fold that will read and consume and contribute to this kind of world of the community. So it's difficult. And I think, you know, the traffic numbers aren't the greatest for some of those niche websites like that, but I think you can continue to grow. You can continue to do more things to explain it better to people. And in the end, that's really, you know, it's for all sports fans to, you know, be a part of. And we don't want to be exclusionary of anything. It's just acknowledging that some sports fans don't have any interest in learning about this kind of stuff.
Where do you see the current exponential growth of fantasy, whether it's season-long keeper leagues or the daily fantasy and weekly fantasy leagues? Where does that fit into the growth of a general and expanding public interest in analytics and deeper statistics?
You know, that's where a lot of money is, obviously, within analytics. You know, you look at March Madness pools, you look at, you know, fantasy football, those are near billion-dollar industries themselves. So I think it, you know, it's a good thing, and there's, you know, somewhat of a divide. You won't see much fantasy content at the Sports Analytics blog or the Nylon Calculus site, but there are other websites that do a really good job of it and really are, you know, innovators in the field. You could have saw like NumberFire or Team Rankings. They have tons of resources and data, and a lot of it's public. And I think that's a really good thing to just advance our knowledge. You know, to a certain extent, though, there are teams that are trying to win on the field things, and fantasy is not reality when it comes to building an on-field team that's the best. So it's just a different way of approaching the sports world. And I think that's what a lot of fans are more interested in, is some of the fantasy stuff where they can themselves benefit. Whereas when a team's innovating with sports analytics, it's often behind the scenes and not as exciting for fans. So it's a balance. You know, certain websites have taken different priorities compared to others. And, you know, I don't think a website like Nylon Calculus is making a lot of money compared to maybe a DraftKings or a FanDuel on those websites, which are getting very large valuations, increasingly so, and all sorts of investments and things like that. So there will be more of that. And I think, you know, we saw that with the NBA and their approach to gambling. And I think, you know, some of those rules will be loosened up, and they will just continue to grow and grow. And it's good because it's more people involved in sports data. But it's, you know, a two-headed monster in terms of the different, you know, approaches and the different audiences for those kind of things.
Certainly, and I think it goes without saying that even without the money and the fantasy involved, there still is a growing interest in analytics. Just even with looking at in ESPN investing in a Nate Silver in 538, or even before that, having someone like a John Hollinger in place who was doing stuff with player efficiency rating and deeper analytics for NBA before he, of course, got hired to work in the NBA. And so looking at really the growth of those sites and Nate Silver and other positions of his nature, is there this imminent growth happening in there to make analytics more fit for greater public consumption as opposed to being a more niche community? Are we getting to the point where this whole sports analytics world is not thought of as sort of a geeks-only world?
I think that, you know, that a lot of kudos go to ESPN. They get criticized a lot, but a lot of kudos do go to them for, you know, trying to make this Nate Silver thing work. And for the other websites, you know, Fox has, you know, had some sabermetric stuff on one of the playoff broadcasts, and they've invested a lot of resources with the FanGraphs guys. So I think, you know, some of the, you know, different major media networks are doing a good job of trying to make fans more aware of some of this data and using it in some of the broadcasts and things. So it's a good thing. And, you know, just knowing the field, you know, from different articles that waiting for next year and such, you know, when I would spend all this time on different research and things, it wouldn't get the best numbers or web traffic and such. So I understand that it's just a smaller niche of the sports analytics fans, of sports fans that like this kind of analytics work. But it's a good thing too, to push it a little forward. You know, Sloan is a great conference, and it's fun to network with all sorts of people there. But compared to some of the, you know, research and data that's out there on the internet every day, it's not the most advanced. there's value in that because it's bringing the conversation in a public light a little further almost every year. But it's still frustrating in a sense because there's just as good research, just as innovative stuff happening every day online. It's not Sloan is not innovative because it's bringing the best data out there. It's innovative just because it's doing it for the public eye and putting the same people in a room every year. So that's good. It's good, and it can be frustrating at the same time. So there's this constant tug and pull, pull and tug in the community, in terms of how Sports Index moves forward, of who it's for, who's the best research coming from, who's investing, and who's valuable to. And for me, what I like doing so far is I just like sharing good content. I like telling people that they did a good job. I like making sure that everyone sees the best articles every week. And just, giving back and encouraging more research from a public eye. And there's all sorts of approaches to do that.
And I guess just now that we're living in a sea of data, that the whole notion of the whole, field of analytics is expanding beyond just player personnel decisions and going into stuff like ticket sales and fan experience, as well as you started alluding to with the media end, and that's helping the media to tell stories. So you don't just look at someone's batting average and even OPS, but for basketball, you might look at shots made from a certain part of the floor against a certain defender, and being able to tell us more advanced stories using the analytics to fans. And I know as much as the community might not like seeing the real basic stuff plastered out there first, is that really what the media needs to be doing and should be doing to sort of help the fans start to get used to this advanced data, or is it really just trying to push things to fans that they don't really necessarily want yet?
It's both are fair, and the way I talk about sports analytics, it's kind of just like the finance of sports. It's all this data. Everything is valuable. You can't just ignore certain parts of a company's stock portfolio to make an assessment of whether we want to invest in them. You got to look at all of the data, and so I think it's good that all these sorts of things are happening. It's good that we're becoming more aware, we're becoming more comfortable. Broadcasters are, and I think data is informing all sorts of business decisions in sports. You're right. Dynamic ticket pricing is a great idea of using innovative, sometimes proprietary data, approaches and making decisions that bring in more profit for a business, and all sorts of different social platforms are bringing data to the fold of how to make better decisions. And it's just applicable to everything in life. And that's just how finance is. That's how sports analytics is. And that's all it's about, is just making better decisions with data at hand. So I think it's good that people are becoming more aware of it, and it will just hopefully continue to happen more.
So is it that sort of not dumbing down of it, but really finding the actionable steps within the basic analytics data that allows people in every department of a sports organization and even fans to embrace it? Is that really going to be what helps continue to drive it, even if it frustrates the community that it might be slowing the research growth?
Yeah, some teams are doing a good job with it. Some leagues are doing a good job with it. You look at the NBA themselves. They created this whole stats part of their website with SAP. They invested tons of resources to build a stats website, and the best researchers are using that with SportView data and all that stuff. So there's ways to advance for both, and it's not worth it to get too frustrated about it in either end, because all things are good. Using more data, having data be more common among the average sports fan, and having the research go on among some of the great computer wizards that are out there doing this research is good too. So I like it all. It's all been a good thing. And hopefully we just continue to talk about it more. That's really what it comes down to.
Oh, certainly. And it's interesting to think about that if you have really good data, for example, on a player's pulse rate during a game, you can have the player personnel guys for the organization make great use of it. You can have the training staff make great use of it. You can have the people that are creating content for fans and maybe even partnership sponsorships make great use of it. And so there's no end, I guess, to how you can really embrace analytics, and whether it's no matter who's driving the growth, it's all good for the community from your guys' sense, I guess.
Yeah, and that's what you mentioned was the next step. There's going to be more player tracking. There's going to be more biometric data. There's going to be controversies about who owns that data now. teams can, you know, use it against players in contract negotiations and things. Will players and agents be able to have some of that biometric or blood testing data that they're starting to do in these leagues by teams? But I would like to hopefully see continued growth of the public realm, not just all the innovation happening in teams, because I think it benefits those teams too. You know, if all the innovation of sports analytics ideas is happening from a private perspective, you know, we're not benefiting from it. And it might even hurt teams because they're just kind of stuck in their way of doing things, even if they're trying to innovate themselves. So there will be lots of more conversations with this, lots more companies joining the fold, and it's all good, I think, in the end, as long as, you know, the conversations are happening to inform the public, conversations are happening and innovation is happening in the public eye for, you know, those researchers, and then the teams are obviously doing all sorts of things we don't have any idea about yet.
And Jacob, we're talking a little bit in abstracts, I guess, as well, but which sports overall are really doing the best and which are kind of behind the eight ball when it comes to embracing analytics?
Knowledge of it. I think baseball is still like 5 years ahead of where NBA and NHL are, you know, and that has hurt and helped some things. You know, baseball's, you know, Moneyball, everything. Most every baseball team has a Saber, they have baseball analytics people in their staff that's integrated in their scouting and development personalities and everything. And they track so much data from all their hundreds of minor leaguers and everything. And the NBA and NHL are just starting to hire and build those infrastructures themselves. And then the NFL is maybe 10 years behind the NBA and the NHL. There's still a lot of data things missing from the infrastructures of football franchises. And so, baseball is definitely first. And that's in the nature of the game to a certain extent. These independent interactions between pitcher and batter that are all trackable and data worthy. While in NBA and NHL and NFL, there are all these, you know, constantly continuous movements of players and bodies and ball happening all over the place, which just by nature harder to track every individual thing. So it makes sense why baseball is far and ahead beyond the other leagues.
Certainly. And how about for people in your community of people that are really interested in the sports analytics world, where is the growth happening there? Are they looking at particular sports? Are they looking at how can we use some of this data to make money, whether it's through gambling or through serving fantasy sites and gambling sites, or is it just for your own edification? We want to learn about these things. We want to create the next great statistic.
I think it's happening in all sorts of sports, and it's happening in all sorts of ways. I enjoy some of the more, here's the next great statistic, or here's a new approach of using this data to look at that. And there's a lot of free data available for these North American sports leagues of, you know, a way you can approach, you know, a new PER type stat in basketball, or, you know, let's not forget this is how players shoot in this way using this data. So it's all fun. Soccer, I feel kind of bad for the people that are interested in doing research in the soccer world, because there's not the data resources, the data platforms like we have for North American sports leagues aren't as robust. You kind of have to count or track your own data in soccer. So it's unfortunate, but I know that the teams and some of the researchers are doing great work in that realm too. So in North American sports leagues, if you're interested in doing sports analytics research, there's data out there. Use it. It's on ESPN. It's on baseballreference.com. It's on Fangraphs. It's everywhere. And so the more people that are playing with that data and taking different approaches to it, the better.
And I know everyone these days seems to be interested in how data can advance thoughts and ideas, no matter really what perspective you're looking at it from. But is there still any notion of resistance out there? And what are some of the objections that you might come across, whether it's through your research or through anecdotal evidence and observation yourself?
I don't think there's really that many objections to it anymore, unless, you know, the biggest issue that continues to affect the sports analytics world is not like, you know, the jocks resisting it. It's, I think, communication. If you can communicate the information that you're extrapolating in a actionable, meaningful way to actually change something, as opposed to just being theoretical. If you can say, we should be doing this in a slightly different way because of this, and this is what will result of it, and you can say it in a concise, actionable way, things will happen better. I think, you know, the struggles in analytics are the folks that will do this research, but not like have it matter or not have it actionable in a real way. It's just, you know, a stat. Okay, it's a neat stat, but what does it mean? So what? How could a T team take advantage of that stat? What, you know, how would that player benefit from knowing that stat? What could they do better next time? You know, that's the kind of, you know, struggles that do exist a little bit still today.
Well, that's interesting. And I think also the looking at maybe some of the ways that you can not necessarily misuse data, but use it to tell a story you want to tell, as you kind of mentioned earlier with an agent trying to show that his player is the best, or even right now with the college football playoff, everyone trying to show how this stat shows that they're better, or this stat shows that they're more deserving. And so you can certainly, you know, weave the data around to tell the stories you want to tell. And so I guess it's about finding the most objective way to tell it and the one that will allow you to take the proper action step.
Mm-hmm. So there's, you know, data is going to be everywhere, and it will continue to be in every industry. And it's, you know, it's fun to see what's happening in sports.
You're just a sports geek at heart. But
that's what it is.
Having a great conversation about sports analytics with sports analytics blog writer, as well as a MBA candidate at the University of Oregon Warsaw Sports Marketing Program, Jacob Rosen. Before we get to this episode's shareable stat, though, Jacob, you do a great job on waiting for next year, the Cleveland Sports Blog, which I think is really a fantastic site and really a paradigm for local sports websites, location-focused blogs. You're starting to see, you know, obviously ESPN New York's been around for a while, ESPN LA, ESPN Dallas, it seems like they're having every region covered now. There are a lot of geo-focused websites like Waiting For Next Year out there. What's your general thought on how important they are and what kind of staying power they have? Or ultimately, will an ESPN just sort of take over and have their own separate sites for different segments?
That would disappoint me too a little bit. You know, Waiting For Next Year is unique because it's a wholly independent site. It's not a part of the SB Nation network or the Bleacher Report network or Fansided or anything. Waiting For Next Year was just created by three guys who were writing their own Cleveland sports websites and wanted to collaborate. And it's been around for almost 7 years now. And that's kind of rare in today's environment. Lots of other independent sports blogs are getting bought out by, you know, regional sports networks or some of these big conglomerates or anything, or just merging with them. It's hard to keep it going. You know, we think we hit lulls here or there. We try to innovate with this or do a redesign there. But it's great. It's, you know, just as a writer of anything, it's fun to have these independent sites, not in one of those big conglomerates. It's, you know, I've become some of a Bleacher Report snob here and there. You know, I like having these independent blogs. I like having, you know, the really nerdy, geeky, or like super hyper focused on this kind of thing. But it's tough to, you know, make it worth it sometimes. It's, you know, ESPN could better monetize an ESPN Cleveland blogger than we can, and we're just a bunch of fans. You know, we don't, none of us have this as our job. Waiting For Next Year is just a blog of, you know, maybe now like 15 guys with all sorts of real jobs, and we just blog or post news stories whenever we can and hope that our readers are enjoying it and other people are picking it up and things like that. It's just a hobby for all of us, so it's fun, and I wish that there would be more and more independent sites from fans and, you know, just admirers of the game.
Is a site like WFNY, are you guys at the point now where you're thinking beyond just here's what I want to write about, here's what the fans are talking about, to thinking of, okay, here's some topic or some content that we can produce because of our closeness, proximity, affinity with the fan base and with the Cleveland sports franchises that a national outlet like an ESPN would have more trouble covering? Or are you still just, is that not driving your decisions for content at this point yet?
It sometimes is. You know, we just did a neat little video series on Browns fans in New York. We try and do some fun things. We have credentialed access to the Cleveland sports teams. So there are still features and things like that we are continuing to explore. I've done a lot of different data analytics articles at the sites and things. So, you know, there's a niche for Waiting For Next Year's out there, and we can continue to be successful and innovative. And it's, you know, neat to have no hierarchical bosses. It's not nice to not have ESPN saying this is what you have to write, or, you know, to force this content. So it can be more natural. It can be easier to consume as opposed to some of the other websites. And we try to, you know, really listen to our, you know, our readers and our other bloggers to see what they want to do and things like that.
And having that close relationship with the fans can still go a long way. And I hope that Waiting For Next Year continues to stay strong for a while. But really enjoyed talking to you, Jacob. We'll be right back with some fun with you in our Jive with Jacob session. Some quick hitting questions for Jacob Rosen. But first, we'll be right back with this episode's shareable stat, something a sports geek like Jacob can appreciate. We'll be right back. enjoyed chatting with Jacob Rosen. Great discussion about the sports analytics world and really how it's growing, how it's evolving really across the board, and really interesting field to watch, whether you're looking at it from a media and network perspective or from the inside with player personnel and what's going on the field with the talent perspective. But we'll have a little bit of fun come up with Jacob in our Jive with Jacob session, some fun quick-hitting questions, get to know a little more about him and his experience. But before that, we have this episode's shareable stat. This episode's shareable stat comes from a recent New York Times article looking at the growth of daily fantasy sites, and it comes from the CEO of FanDuel, who said that over the last year, FanDuel has grown in women twice as fast in men when it comes to enrollment on their site. So we know that those kinds of fantasy sites have been enjoying great growth, and it's fascinating to see this episode's shareable stat that according to their CEO, that women are joining the site at a rate twice as quickly as men. So what does that mean for sports marketers? It means that, well, as much as we try to cater to the female demographic, knowing there's a ton of great potential there, and stats like this bear it out, it means that you don't need to necessarily create new categories or new marketing tactics or new assets to market to women. They are, a lot of times, fans of sports the same way that men are, and that includes fantasy sports. They're not looking at which players are the most attractive or look the best in their uniforms when it comes to putting together their fantasy teams. They are looking at the same stats and breakdowns and trying to win money and pride and avoid those crazy loser prizes that men are in their fantasy leagues and their daily fantasy sites. So really, it's about looking at those categories and those assets that have already been a great success in the past with your fans, and especially among the males, and making sure that women aren't missing out on those opportunities as well. Whether that means targeted advertisements toward females, making sure you're fishing where they are on the internet, and looking at the trends in which they discover new things and try out new things, and just making sure that everything is put in front of them and the same opportunities are given to women as much as men, and really treating them the same across the board, because there's been a lot of valuable and successful sports marketing assets and tactics out there, and now it's time to get all those female fans involved just as much as the men have always been. And this episode's shareable stat is a great testament to that, as FanDuel has seen twice as many women join the site as men in the recent past, according to their CEO. So that's this episode's shareable stat. Really think about it. I think it's really interesting. Ponder it and put it to use wherever you may be. All right, that's the episode's shareable stat. We'll be right back, have a little fun with Jacob Rosen. We've been talking some sports analytics, and we'll talk a little bit more and also have a little fun in our Jive with Jacob segment. Coming right back at you. All right, welcome back. That was this episode's shareable stat, and it looks at the growth of fantasy, especially weekly fantasy or short-term fantasy like FanDuel and DraftKings, but looking specifically at the growth of women on fantasy sites. Are you seeing how about the growth of women in the analytics world, Jacob?
It's, you know, I think I like 12% of my Twitter followers are women. So it's, you know, there are still, you know, I know there are a lot of great researchers in different of these sports that are women. So it's interesting to see, you know, their growth and participation. And they really are, you know, there's no way in which we should talk down to them. We need to, you know, there's ways in which they're interacting and things like that. So it's good, and it's fun to see all sorts of different people from different backgrounds participate in all these different numbers things too.
A lot of bright women and bright academic women out there, yes. And it's a way for females to get involved in pro sports when they can't compete on the same field as men necessarily.
Perhaps, yeah. So it's all a good thing.
Very cool. All right, Jacob, you survived your interview, sir. Are you ready now for a little jive with Jacob?
Let's do it.
All right, let's have some fun. Number one for you. You've been working in the field of analytics, it seems like, forever, going back to your days playing around with BCS rankings. So tell me, as you've been writing in the sports analytics world and researching, the most fascinating piece of data or finding that you've uncovered in your research or writing.
Phew, that's hard. I've done a lot of the work I've done has been like adding on to existing research. But I guess one of the most fun things I did was I looked at regression to the mean in the NBA and the Major League Baseball. So I could tell you that like the NBA, the Cavs were such a bad team for many years, that a sub-30 win team, so if you know your favorite team wins 28 games, just by average, those teams have improved by 9 wins next season. So the kind of research there has kind of been fun to look at in terms of how teams regress to the mean on average in terms of just their natural development and you know moving back to a 500 record.
That's interesting. Hear that, Sixers fans? There is hope for next season.
I wouldn't still go so far with the Sixers, but on average.
some teams just break the average, I guess.
Yes.
All right, number two for you, Jacob. What is – you've come across statistics all the time, whether it's a certain – one single number in a given situation or a certain type of statistic. So however you want to interpret it, tell me the most informative single stat you've come across in your study of sports and analytics.
I think the most basic one is – it's not basic, but the best one I think in almost any sport is Pythagorean win percentage. This is a old Bill James idiom. It's using runs scored or points scored against points allowed to find a team's expected win percentage using a derivative of the Pythagorean theorem from geometry. And it's a better measure of team success in the future than just their win-loss record. So if you look at their actual point differential or run differential, you get a better indicator of how they'll do in the future than just based on a small sample size of games. So I think that stat, if you know anything about sports analytics, is a great thing to know in terms of you know who might win a certain game. Run differential is better than record.
So does that mean then that that those college football teams battling for the playoffs should be trying to blow out teams?
You know, that's all a ranking, but I think, you know, when you look at like a playoff matchup or you look at, you know, we're a quarter of the way through the NBA season, who will do better going forward? Looking at the differential in points is really a big thing. You know, you want to have more blowout wins, you want to have fewer blowout losses. Those kind of things do matter in a longer run as opposed to just, you know, in a ranking for college football, it's all over the place too, you know. It's all based on impressions and a couple of humans putting it together. But in a sport where there's so many games by the end of things, the run differential does, you know, show more in the long run.
Interesting. All right, number three for you. We discussed a little bit in the interview. I want to hear you spout off about it. The pro sport that has the most room to grow with analytics in general and the sport that has embraced it the best so far and why?
The NFL has the most room to grow. There's all sorts of ways in which data and analytics can affect decision making, and I think Major League Baseball is by far the best. And even still, they're doing a lot more. Statcast, which is the sport VU of Major League Baseball, is coming out next year. There'll be all sorts of new data to play with, and so I think baseball is just you know 10 years ahead of any other league in terms of all the data that's happening. And the NFL is 15 years behind.
And a quick tangent there, too, with the NFL. Is it because there's a dearth of researchers and people studying it, or is it just not the existence of the data yet?
There's some data out there, and you know, there's some great resources. You know, look at Football Outsiders or Football Perspective. There are really good websites on football data. I just don't think that maybe they're not communicating it in an effective way. Maybe teams aren't seeing the value of it in certain ways. But it's just not compared to baseball at all.
Okay. All right, number four for you, Jacob. The sport and or TV network that has best started to actually integrate analytics into its coverage on TV and or social and web?
So I think ESPN as a network deserves as much blame as they get all the time. They do deserve credit for the investment that they've had in terms of trying to show war or show different stats in a different way. And Fox has done a lot by having their Just a Bit Outside combination with the Fangraphs guys and putting it on their playoff broadcasts. So as much flack as we give them, those websites, those networks have done a good job, especially in sports like baseball first.
Oh, certainly. And it gives them some good insider content, I think, as well for ESPN. And, of course, people are liking the sports science segments that are showing up on SportsCenter and whatnot as well.
Some of that's not the most analytically advanced, but it's using numbers with sports. And so that's really, the goal in any way.
Certainly, it's a step forward.
Yeah.
Number five for you, Jacob. The sport whose fans seem most interested and informed when it comes to analytics.
Baseball fans. Baseball fans grew up around scorebooks. They grew up around batting average and RBI. And I think compared to other leagues, they're using more other stats. They're using OPS. They're using WAR as opposed to batting average and RBI these days. Maybe it's not even a majority of them yet, but I think percentage-wise of baseball fans, they're becoming more and more acclimated with this analytics movement, with sabermetrics, with better data than just batting average and RBI, compared to NBA, where, you know, fans are still obsessed with points per game, and, you know, they talk about the rings in basketball, and they don't talk about, you know, all sorts of other stats that contribute to an overall team's, you know, ability to win games.
Certainly, and I think it just goes to show, too, that baseball overall has had a love affair with statistics really going back throughout its history.
Yeah. It's easy to quantify. The independent actions make it a great environment for data research.
There's a reason everyone knows all those baseball records off the top of their head, but can't name too many others when it comes to pro sports.
Yeah.
All right, number six for you, Jacob. In our Jive with Jacob segment, having some fun talking to Jacob Rosen. The most popular or controversial article you've written across the publications you've worked on. So what generated the most sort of conversation or buzz?
I think perhaps the most popular one I wrote was one where I called out Nate Silver. He wrote an article this summer, you know, back in May, about Kyrie Irving of the Cavaliers. He looked at different lottery picks from the NBA and their career development. But in his research and talking about how players grow from like their fifth year to their, you know, 10th year, when talking about a max contract for Kyrie Irving, he didn't include the fact that Kyrie Irving was the third youngest number one overall pick ever, and that draft picks today are way younger than draft picks were 20 or 30 years ago. So the sample size and the data he looked at wasn't really accurate for how young Kyrie Irving is. And so I made the claim that age is just as important as years in the league and years of experience. And so that got a lot of buzz, I think, back this summer, where people were sharing and say, oh yeah, I guess that's true, you know.
Certainly.
You should compare Kyrie to LeBron James's career development as opposed to a guy like, you know, a guy that was drafted 30 years ago when he was 23 years old, considering that Kyrie Irving himself is still 22. So it's not really fair to compare his career development to guys that went for 4 years of college.
Oh, it makes a lot of sense from your end. Very interesting. And it's good that people do not just look at a Nate Silver and take whatever he says as gospel, yeah. and to look at, okay, where are you coming up with these statistics and these predictions and such.
The back and forth is good.
Very good. All right, number seven for you. I'm throwing a little bonus here, courtesy of your current roommate, Will. He says that you have a cool story about your favorite player, someone that might not be everyone's favorite player, Dave Roberts. Tell me about your experience with Dave Roberts and something cool he did for you.
That's awesome that Will reached out to you for that. So Dave Roberts and I, we were, I guess you could say, like pen pals or such back in the day. I would come up to him at games. I first met him when he got traded to the Indians in like 98. He was just a minor leaguer for the Indians organization. We went to his debut with the Indians organization, and we were sitting next to his UCLA base running coach. And so I got his batting glove, his bat that night. We would, you know, write, you know, holiday letters. He would sign autographs for me, gave me his baseball gloves, all this stuff for years when he was in the minors.
Wow.
And then obviously in 2004, Dave Roberts became a superstar when he stole that base to the Red Sox. They won the World Series. And I really haven't been in touch with him, but he's just, you know, always been my favorite athlete in sports. And a couple weeks back, a guy from the Browns front office, who I know on Twitter, Brent Stellick, who's a VP with the Browns, had seen one of my tweets of how much I love Dave Roberts. And when I moved out to Oregon, sent me a care package, including a baseball from Dave Roberts saying, Jacob, good luck at Oregon, signed Dave Roberts. And
that's
so
incredible.
Yeah, it's been, you know, 10, 15 years since I've chatted all with Dave Roberts, but he was always my favorite. And it was so nice of Brent and so nice of Dave to send, you know, that kind of appreciation.
And that is awesome. I you know, I can't imagine how excited you were, even if you're not a Red Sox fan too, of that moment when he made maybe the most famous stolen base of all time in that game.
And there's nobody better in sports. I know he's battled some health issues over the years, so there's nobody better in sports. I'm glad to see he's doing well for the Padres, and I always appreciate, you know, I have a signed picture of him as well from one of the different media days or something where I saw him in Buffalo. So he was always my favorite, and there's nobody better.
Wow, I can say as a Padres fan, I definitely support Dave Roberts, and really it's great to hear about a genuinely good guy who does things like that don't get publicized.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Jacob, number eight for you. I enjoyed that last one, so let's see if you can beat yourself. The most interesting thing most people do not know about your alma mater, University of Dayton.
I think most interesting thing people don't know is like about 98% of students live on campus. The university owns all the property nearby, so it's just a big student neighborhood. It's, you know, a Catholic school, and it's just a lot of fun having everything nearby and walking distance. So it was all through university housing all my 4 years, and it was just a blast being near everyone and everything all the time. So I loved my time at Dayton.
That's great. Hey, go Flyers. Mm-hmm. All right, number nine for you, Jacob. As a longtime Cleveland fan, for better or for worse, we know all about the Cleveland suffering Cleveland fans. Your favorite or most notable Cleveland sports memory?
My most favorite Cleveland sports memory was probably the 2006 playoffs in the NBA. When I remember we beat the Wizards and maybe it was the second round, and the fans left the queue chanting Eric Snow for MVP. Eric Snow was our mediocre backup point guard, or starting, I guess, then. But we left the game chanting Eric Snow MVP, and so that was a really cool moment for me.
Wow.
That's how sad it is to a certain extent that I don't have any championship or, you know, World Series game or anything that's really happened, because we got blown out in two of the seven finals. We had LeBron leave. The Indians made it to two World Series and lost. So that's like my favorite moment of Cleveland sports.
Let me ask you this real quickly. Did the decision part two make up for the decision part one?
I'm from Akron, so I'm from LeBron's hometown. He's always been very good to Akron. So I was excited for my favorite team to be good again. And he's been always good to Akron. So did it make up for it? Sure, yeah. You know, I'm excited that we're good because it's fun again. LeBron's always been good to us, and he'll be with us for the rest of his career. So it was still shock and disbelief when it happened. And it feels good. It's fun to, you know, see someone care so much about their region.
Great. All right, number 10 for you, Jacob. And this, if there's one thing that social media loves more than sports or as much as sports, it is food. So you're currently at University of Oregon, up in their sports marketing program, the Warsaw sports marketing program. So what is the best food to get around the University of Oregon?
I haven't explored all that much in just the 3 months I've been here. But my favorite spot so far has been Papa's Soul Food out in the Whitaker District, about, you know, a mile or so from campus. It's a really good soul food, southern barbecue place. Went there a couple times with my mom when I moved out here, so that's my favorite spot.
Okay. Interesting. Hear that, fans? You don't need to go south for some good soul food. Just head up to Oregon.
There's all sorts of hippie, funky breakfast places and coffee shops too, but that was my favorite food I had.
And you'll have plenty of time to explore, I'm sure. That sounds good, though, to me. All right, lastly, a little bonus to get you out on here. Your pick, as a long-suffering Cleveland fan, which Cleveland team will finally deliver a championship you guys have been waiting for?
I think the Cavs, just in the next few years, they'll make enough finals with how bad the Eastern Conference is that they'll win something in the next 4 years. But I guess after that, you know, the Cavs, will, you know, maybe it's an easy, too easy of one, but after that, I'll probably go with the Indians. Just because in baseball, and they've been a good team the last years, 92 and 85 wins, you just got to make the playoffs. We saw with the Royals this year, the playoffs in baseball, more so than any other sport, are just such a crapshoot compared to the 162-game season. So if the Indians can just make the playoffs again in the next few years, I think they would have a shot to make a Royals-like run and you know, maybe win it themselves.
Do you think Cavs fans, are they still a little anxious, I guess, or do they expect to win a championship at this point because LeBron is there with Kevin Love and Kyrie Irving, or is it still, I'll believe it when I see it?
You know, Cleveland fans are ruthless sometimes. You know, you look at the Browns and Browns fans, they're always angsty and things like that. So, yeah, we're not too confident, but expectations are certainly really, really high, and you know, we're on edge that we're only 10-7 and things like that. So there will be frustration no matter what happens. If they make the finals and lose this year, people will freak out. And so the expectations are ridiculously high. But I think, you know, the Eastern Conference is just so bad that the Cavs will make enough finals to win one at least the next few years here.
Hey, well, the hopes are as high as they've ever been, so that's a good thing. All right, Jacob, you made it through your interview. That was a lot of fun, our Jive with Jacob segment. Now it's your chance to take over the podcast and give us your social media all-star to follow. Someone out there on Twitter or a blogger, whoever it may be, who they are, why they're worth following.
So I'll give a shout-out to Seth Partnow, P-A-R-T-N-O-W. Seth Partnow is a writer at the Nylon Calculus site with me. He also writes at Fancy Stats, The Washington Post, Basketball Breakdown, Clipper Blog, and like a bunch of other different websites. So Seth's a really better writer than me. He's way better with data. He's also from Alaska, so that's pretty cool. But Seth's a great guy, and I know he writes at all these different websites and is kind of criminally underappreciated. So I'll give a shout out for everyone to follow Seth Partnow.
Oh, that's great. We'll definitely have to link him up and check out some of the writing that he does, especially if you claim it's better than yours.
Yeah, he's really good. And you know, appreciation for all the different editors I have at, you know, Jonathan Gordon at Sports Analytics Blog, Ian Levy at Nylon Calculus, and Scott Sargent at Waiting for Next Year. But Seth, I wanted to give a shout out to Seth because not enough people follow him.
That's great. And speaking of all those places that we get that you write for, give us an idea, where can we find you all across social media and on the web?
So you can find me at waitingfornextyear.com, nylonecalculus.com, sportsanalyticsblog.com. I also write for the Warsaw Sports Marketing Center blog at warsaw.sportsblog.com. And then I'm on Twitter at WFNYJacob. I have a personal account, UDJ Rosen, which is, you know, my old Dayton name. And then just for fun, I also run a pizza roundup blog, a Twitter account too. So you can find me at Pizza Roundup. If you like pizza and want to talk about pizza, you can talk with me there.
And of course, you can check out the work that Jacob does on the side with the Akron Rubber Ducks. If you have any ideas for him with the Rubber Ducks, you can send them his way. Great conversation, Jacob. Really learned a lot from you. I think listeners should be excited to learn about analytics from you and all the work you do, and you certainly have a bright future in the sports business and sports analytics industry wherever you want to go. And really appreciate you giving us some of your time and joining us on the podcast tonight.
Thanks, Neil. It was a blast.
And hey, best of luck to your Cleveland teams. I think a championship will finally come to that city at some point.
We'll be waiting for next year.
Take care, Jacob.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much again to Jacob. Really cool talking to him. Really great to hear how passionate he really is about the subject and how much initiative he's taken to develop himself and develop the small but growing community of sports analytics of which he is becoming an integral part. But really enjoyed his time, and we thank him a lot for sharing some of his knowledge with us, and wish him the best in his career and his future as he looks to finish out his career, his studies there at the University of Oregon Warsaw Sports Marketing Program, get that MBA, and then who knows what he'll do in the greater sports business world. But that'll do it for this episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. As always, thank you for listening. I'm your host, Neil Horwitz. Get more info at dsmsports.net. Check out some of our other episodes. And follow me on Twitter at njh287. Always love to hear from anyone who listens to the podcast. All right, that'll do it. Enjoy your holiday season, and we'll be coming back at you soon after the holidays with some new episodes of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast.